Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation author event. I apologize that we're starting a few minutes late. We had some technical difficulties, so thank you very much for your patience. My name is Daniel Blank, and I'm the Managing Director of Public Programs at the Foundation, where, among other roles, I lead this acclaimed author event series. This series is one of this city's great cultural treasures. By bringing authors together with readers, we create a space for exciting and meaningful conversations, and we make the literary world accessible to the Philadelphia community. The library, I should note, is a nonpartisan organization, respectful of many different perspectives and viewpoints, but I did want to say, especially today, at a moment of intense political polarization, at a moment of heightened emotions for many of us, it feels particularly important to foster the kinds of civic dialogue that this series promotes. So I'm very glad to have you all with us for this timely event. Before we get to tonight's program, and before I introduce our two distinguished speakers, I want to say just a few words about our organization. The Foundation works to expand the Free Library's programming and advance its mission of promoting literacy throughout the Philadelphia region. As a nonprofit, we are reliant upon your support to achieve these goals, so please do consider donating. There is a QR code on those handy bookmarks that you may have been handed as you came in. You can also donate through our website, freelibrary.org. I'd like to take a moment as well to thank our volunteers, who are a dedicated group of library supporters who help to make these programs possible. Tonight we have Paula, Lindsay, and Tom with us, and we are very grateful to them. Tonight we welcome Andre Robert Lee, a filmmaker, writer, and educator who has committed his entire career to building an army of change agents. His process includes many things: New York City Public Schools, the Ford Foundation, Miramax Films, Urban World, Film Movement, Diana Ross, BET, Universal, PBS, HBO, Sundance, Picture House, and DreamWorks. Among Andre's many director and producer credits is the award-winning film Virtually Free, in which he told the story of incarcerated youth in Richmond. And I should also note that all of Andre's films are available through his website. Andre most recently served as the executive producer of the public radio program Notes from America with Kai Wright, and he is the namesake of the Andre Robert Lee Fellowship, a multi-million dollar program dedicated to providing financial grants, mentorship, and leadership opportunities for high school students while building a stronger culture of affinity and inclusion. He will be joined in conversation this evening by Cherry Gregg, who is the afternoon drive host and news anchor for WHYY Radio, and co-host of the daily news show Studio 2. Prior to her current position, she covered civil rights, social justice, race and public affairs issues impacting marginalized communities, spending nearly a decade on air at KYW News Radio and CBS 3 Eyewitness News. Cherry is also a licensed attorney, and she is a founding member of the board of directors of the Law and Justice Journalism Project, a nonprofit focused on shifting the journalism narrative around public safety, crime, and justice. I can't imagine a better program for tonight. Please join me in welcoming Andre Robert Lee and Cherry Gregg.
Good evening. How y'all doing? Good. Feel pretty good? Well, maybe not. Maybe you do. I don't know how you feel. So, welcome to this conversation. I'm excited to be here with you. Yeah, get your mic.
I'm excited too.
thank you for asking me to do this. And I honestly, when I said yes, I didn't realize it would be the day after the election. And I know you, a lot of people stayed up late last night. I'm sure you did too. Mm-hmm. And so I thought we would start a conversation because I know you had a hand working a little bit on the Harris campaign. How are you feeling the day after the election? How are you feeling?
That's a heavy question. You know, my heart is heavy
You know, we did a lot of work, and I was really excited about the opportunity and the change and what could happen. I'm also excited about the future and what could happen. I saw her concession speech, mm-hmm. which is really powerful, and the whole notion of the light that is America shines bright, and we can also all work to make that bright, that light even brighter. I was thinking about this when I first started working on a campaign, it was the Biden campaign, and then it switched to Harris, and we had this long conversation about how do we convince America to stop saying Kamala and start saying Harris, which is a really interesting moment, and we're thinking about what are the ways to structure this and put it out there in ways that would really encourage people to see her as a very serious candidate, someone that we should look to as a leader. So all that said, my heart is heavy, you know, with how things went. And I was thinking about this. I want to say this to anyone in the room who identifies as female. I'm sorry. Like, it's a moment to witness what just happened in America. So I extend that to you from my heart. So my emotions are all over the place. I was on the mall, I guess, two nights ago already, seeing Lady Gaga and Ricky Martin and them, you know, and walked out like, it's going to happen. And then last night at about 11, we were like, uh-oh. And I connect that to, I was actually at Javits Center in 2016, that same situation. We're all excited. We ran through the gates. And by 11:30, we're like, uh-oh. So it's kind of remarkable. So my feelings are all over the place. But being here tonight makes it feel a lot better, actually.
Yeah, it's very grounding to mm-hmm. look out and see mm-hmm. smiling faces and people here to talk about your work. And for folks who may not know, though, I want you to just briefly, they hired you. Yeah. As a filmmaker,
yeah.
to help with messaging and to tell us about the work that you did, and then we'll show a clip.
Okay. Yeah, so I was brought in as a director and a creative director for the various spots related to the campaign. Something they said, which I really appreciated, they wanted an African-American person to helm certain parts of the project. And I said to them in the first meeting, I said, if you have that, I want you to really have that full experience. So if I have ideas, let's make sure they're met and appreciate it. So I was brought in to think about concepts and ideas related to how to advertise and push for the campaign. I was brought in to travel around the country and go to various spots and actually interview people. They liked my documentary style, and they wanted an approach to storytelling that was different than the typical ad campaign. They wanted someone that could actually lean into storytelling and knew how to talk to people. So I was talking to volunteers around the country, pre-interviewing them, and then actually going and sitting down and interviewing them, bringing that back to the studio and cutting pieces together to sort of tell the story. So I was director, creative director, writer, kind of everything. And to give you the schedule, we would shoot Sunday. Legal would approve what we shot on Monday. We started editing on Tuesday. It was on TV by Friday. And for anyone who knows anything about scheduling, that was really fast.
Yeah. Look, we did a whole show on, you know, political ads, and y'all move. This is called, it's like next level filmmaking.
Yeah.
And so I want people to get an idea of some of the work you did. You did a lot more than this, but where there was this effort to try to hone in on the black male vote. And it's called, this piece is called Opportunity Economy. Take a look.
Around here, we have hardworking people that just need a break. Whether it's starting a small business or making housing affordable, Kamala understands that. When people tell me that they don't believe in Vice President Harris, I point to the things that I'm doing. And when they're excited about me, you know, working with kids, I say, I can't do this without that grant that came from the federal government. She's had our back since day one. Let's be honest and get a reality check. Women know how to make things happen, and we're going to stand up with her on November 5th.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
Women know how to make things happen.
I had to fight for that line.
Really?
I was like, we're ending with this line. And they were like, well, is it two on the nose? Does it? And I was like, no, let's stay with this line. And
finish.
Yeah, and I think what happened, that piece got picked up by the New York Times.
Yeah.
And there's a huge article talking about the experience of ads and targeting black men. And they mentioned that line, which I was so excited about because I thought it said so much, you know, and he said that. I didn't have to write it. I just extracted it from from Anton is his name.
Yeah, Anton Moore. I've seen a real community activist known in South Philadelphia, runs a carpentry program for young men. to help them build their lives.
Yeah.
Beautiful choice.
Yeah.
But this sort of goes back to your whole storytelling style. First of all, I just want people to know it's hard to tell a full story in 30 seconds. Kudos to you, Andre, for doing that.
We did 14 that week.
Whoa, yeah. 14 different spots?
Yeah, that day was like 7.
Can we give Andre a round of applause for for marathon filmmaking?
Thank you.
Beautiful job. And of course, you know, 80% of black men did vote for Kamala Harris. And so I want to zoom out because you have this love for storytelling, a passion for telling stories about history, about justice, that are nuanced and wrapped in emotion. Where did this passion come from?
I grew up here in North Philadelphia. I wanted to be a filmmaker, but I was afraid that I didn't have the ability to achieve it because of nepotism, finances, and who was I, a little kid from North Philly, wanting to be a filmmaker. And so when I started receiving scholarships to high school and college, I had this idea that as a black man who received all this support, I had to do something that gave back more to the world. So I became a teacher, which was great. And make a long story short, I was working at the Ford Foundation, had a research project, and I came across two films. One was the film Rosie the Riveter, which I had seen as an 11th grader, had seen it as a junior in college, and now here I was reading the articles and the letters about how I got funded. And then I came across James Baldwin's The Price of the Ticket and the Ford Foundation Library, which is a researcher's dream. I'm like holding letters written by James Baldwin wearing white gloves, watching him beg for money for the foundation. And I had a moment. I was like, oh, film is education. Mm. And so I quit the Ford Foundation. Within like a month, I was on a Spike Lee movie. Like, he wants an award to Mr. Lee, which was quite a moment. And so that's when I married the idea of education and film. And I had always had the title for this next film that we're talking about since ninth grade. Because I went to this school and this huge scholarship, my life was just changed, and it was kind of shocking. And I've been committed to the idea of showing the world what access means since I was in ninth grade. I honestly have been. And filmmaking has been the vehicle and the tool to help me try and do that and share with people.
Yeah, and you've teed it up perfectly. We're going to take a look at The Prep School Negro, one of your first films. Take a look.
The experience here was like incredible and really horrible in some ways at the same time.
Yeah.
The incredible part was the exposure, reading black authors for the first time and this and that and the different environments, learning about different cultures. What were some of the things that made it so difficult?
The assimilation process is very, very difficult. I came here and felt invisible. And I mean, I still do. That's why it is that people don't even know and remember that I was here. And I don't think that's what I thought high school would be like. I expected my high school experience to be very, very different.
And I remember being here in September, and I was like, where's everybody at? Like the third week of school? And they're like, oh, it's a holiday. I was like, what holiday? And they said, it's Rosh Hashanah. And I was like, what grade is she in?
Mercy, I've never heard this. I didn't know. Oh, Andre, God bless you.
Struggle.
Well, prior to GFS, I'd never been in a school where I was in the minority. I'd always gone to schools that were predominantly black. I got here and I didn't know anything. I didn't understand how long classes were. I didn't understand people sitting on the floor. I didn't understand why there were book bags everywhere,
right,
all over everything.
And it's funny you mentioned the bags, because I remember looking at all the bags on the shelf and thinking, like, you couldn't do this. You can't do this in my neighborhood.
GFS appeared to be the utopia I had imagined outside my window. It was founded by the Religious Society of Friends, Quakers, in 1845. The school did not have its first African-American graduate until more than a century later in 1958. The academic standard is extremely high. We had incredible teachers. The majority of them had PhDs and were published. Practically every GFS graduate goes on to college, many to the Ivy League. To put that into perspective, at Germantown High, the public high school that my sister went to, 40% of students dropped out.
That statistic, Andre. And you teed this up to talk about access a little bit. How did going to GFS change you? And you kind of talk about this more in the film.
Yeah. You know, it's I smiled when I saw one of my teachers. There's a woman named Charlotte Baker who was in the next clip. And she was my English teacher. I came into the school kind of like, I don't know what's going on. She gave me my first James Baldwin book. And we were reading There Eyes of Watching Guide by Zora Neale Hurston. Mm. And I was struggling with the language. She's like, you have this. And she took me through it. And her lesson was, you know, you are exercising a muscle by understanding two different languages. And what does it mean to understand this language and Shakespeare? We read Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice and Eyes of Watching Guide at the same time. And the whole idea was, look at these two people from two different centuries who are making up language. Mm. And the fact that you can study them is a real gift. And then the other teacher I had, because teachers, I think, are the essence of it. And this woman, like, changed my life. Elizabeth Alexander, who's now president of the Mellon Foundation, and she read the poem at Barack Obama's first inauguration. And that was my teacher in 11th grade. You know, she was at GFS doing her PhD, and she sat me down one year. She said, Andre, you're really cool. People like you, but you know what? You can't write. And we spent the summer reading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and looking at the introduction and reading it again and again. And we just spent the summer at UPenn learning how to write. So the way it changed me was it showed me that I could access a different world through practice, work, and effort. And I had been excluded from a certain parts of the world by my education. And the thought was, you're not a guest in a stranger's house in this school. You belong here, and this place is for you. And that notion right there just popped up. And I remember meeting people and thinking, you're not much smarter than my mother, but you have so much more than my mother. And what is that about? I couldn't identify it as a ninth grader. It just was in my head like, this, something's not right, you know? And as I began to understand systemic issues and my grandmother migrated from the South and the loan she got versus loan someone else would have gotten for their first house was different, which led to an economic pattern. So I'm a ninth grader struggling with all those concepts and ideas and also being like so excited about literature that I hadn't read before. You know, we had summer reading when I first started. And the summer reading was Sula, The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck, and Mary Reynolds, The King Must Die. And I had, by that time...
Ooh, real books right
Yeah,
there.
Right, exactly.
That's real reading, okay?
Exactly. And by then, I had read everything by Judy Blume. That was like the extent of my life. And now, I'm in this whole
world.
That's
what I'm saying. That's a different level, yeah.
Yeah, so it was moments like that. And I'll share one more teacher story that I often share. One of the most difficult teachers at the school, I feel comfortable saying his name was Peter Ranka. And he had this English class. And his thought was, you will leave the school knowing how to write and knowing how to show with your writing versus telling with your writing. You know, we're 11th graders looking around like, what does that mean? And one day he said, Andre, show me, because we had a pop quiz every week for the reading we were doing. And he goes, Andre, show me your lexicon. And I goes, what's a lexicon? He's like, Andre, show me your dictionary. And I pull out the dictionary from my sister's Germantown High School, the little pocket Webster's that was missing A through D, but that's what I had. And he walked me to the bookstore and pulled a book off the shelf and said, this is your new lexicon. And I was like, thank you. And the next day, I got a note from him saying, you owe me 1995 for the book I got you. You know, and the message there was, you know, I'm going to help you help yourself. You know, here is an item for you to use. I'm not giving it to you. I'm showing you what it means to say you can have something different, find a way to own the experience. And all three of them I mentioned just then really shaped me amongst many other teachers at the school.
Yeah. And my follow-up to that is you did a film about it.
Yeah.
You wanted other people to see the transformation, right? And how did doing this film change you?
Yeah, when I started making the movie, I just thought I want to show my mother and my sister what it was like to be at GFS. That was really my biggest driving force behind it. And then my mother became very ill the moment the money fell into place. I was literally in the hospital negotiating with financiers and her doctors. And the movie all of a sudden shifted and changed. And I say making that movie saved my life. It was a real cathartic experience. I don't think I knew that I needed it. And what I've seen, I've traveled all around the country with the movie, and I've seen people just transitioned, you know, from it. And I also want to share this because the WHYY connection in the room. The movie was rejected by almost every single film festival and numerous TV outlets. All the biggies said no. And about during COVID, I get a call from WHYY. She's in the room. And she goes, you know, I want to say first, I'm sorry that your film wasn't shown because you made a film. This is Sri Devi, right? Here I got to point out. Yeah, Sri Devi. You made a film that is exactly what WHYY was designed to do, present marginalized filmmakers, creators, and share local stories. But people prior to you didn't see that. And it was such a blessing to have you say, like, actually, no. And it aired, and from what I remember, it did very, very, very high numbers showing on PBS. So it was the journey with this film, and it's still going. Actually, I have a screening for the film like in 2 weeks, which I still can't believe. But the journey for this film is much bigger than I ever imagined. And I think people connect with it because it is a human story. I'll say one last story that'll be quick, I promise. While editing the film, my editor, Sam Pollard, you know, I stalked Sam Pollard and got him to work for him much less than he should have received. He turns and goes, Andre, you're real brave to make this. And I said, I don't know what that means, and let's not say it again until I finish making this movie, because it might stop me. And afterwards, I realized what he was talking about, because I really just opened my soul up. And the effort was to try and help people verbalize that internal dialogue. What does it mean to discuss the internal self and present it and feel okay about who you are?
Mm-hmm. So interesting that, and I hope people can check out the full film there. And so I want to move on because part of your work as a producer, sometimes you parachute into communities and have to do deep dives and deal with very nuanced, complicated issues that, like I said, twist people in emotional knots. And this is one of those issues. And so I want to tee this one up. This is called This Is Life with Lisa Ling, where you unpack violence in Chicago. Take a look.
This is the start of another violent weekend in Chicago.
55 people were shot over the weekend. Nearly a dozen people died from those shootings.
The numbers are so staggering. 74 people shot, 6 murders.
Chicago is in the headlines almost every week, and all too often, it's bad news.
The number of people shot has already surpassed this time last year.
The number of people losing their lives is impossible to fathom. But if you go back 100 years to a hot summer day on the shores of Lake Michigan, you might begin to understand.
He and 4 of his friends decided to go to the beach along with everyone else. They were ordinary kids.
Black kids.
Black kids, yes, black kids.
What happened to a 17-year-old named Eugene Williams started a chain of events that led from rocks to riots.
They drove into Bronzeville and they opened fire.
To promises broken again and again.
Every family that wants to stay in the community will stay in this community.
I don't see the black people. Where we at?
Do you think things have gotten a lot better in the last 100 years?
Don't worry.
When there's poverty, there's usually a high rate of violence.
Tonight, I'll meet people who have lived that story.
It's like every day you can risk our lives by coming out the door.
And are trying to change the ending.
We have a new brother. How long you been here?
I've been here for 3-4 weeks now.
We have to make killing not cool again.
Intro. And this piece, it aired nationally on CNN. So what is it like to sort of parachute, do your job? I mean, you've done campaigns, you've clearly done biographical pieces, and now in this, you're parachuting in a city as big and diverse and historic as Chicago, and then trying to tell a story about something super complicated and emotional. Tell us about your journey to getting to the root of the issue of violence in that city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll add also, we shot it during COVID.
Oh.
So it was a
journey. You couldn't tell from that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Good job.
Hollywood. Yeah. You know, the group that made that project was called Part Two Pictures. They've worked with Lisa Ling for a very long time, and they reached out to me and asked me to work on the project. And I was like, sure, let's try and figure this out. And what really caught my attention, the Chicago riot happened in 1919, and that's the year my grandmother was born. And I spent a lifetime trying to get my grandmother, my various elders to tell me their stories from migrating from the South, and they would not talk about it. They just would not talk about it because it was too painful. And as an adult, I'm like, yeah, there's no telling what they dealt with, you know? So jumping into Chicago, we did our research. We dug in. I think the real important thing is, and I have one of my kids here. Hey, Joey, that I tell all the time, former student of mine who actually worked on one of my projects. My kids are awesome.
Yeah.
So we had a really great team of people that helped us put it together. And so we did land in Chicago, but we had a good research team, good outreach, and we also had the trust. We had the name Lisa Ling, and she is
fantastic.
People
willing to talk to.
Yeah, she's really fantastic. She's incredible. So going into that city, I'll admit it wasn't that easy. Some people were like, who are y'all coming in to tell this story? You know, you feel like outsiders. But we approached it with a really delicate and respectful hand and lens and approach. And it was challenging, you know, but it's also great. One moment that sort of illustrates what happened there, we were working with a local team, and I wanted footage of this one particular street. And they're like, oh, that street's really dangerous. And I was like, is it dangerous or is it black? Like, I had to be that person, that director, to really get them to go, so let's go down and shoot down this street. And it was in the last remaining of Cabrini Green. We got some great and beautiful footage, but it was really amazing to see people, and this is the role that I had as a director. People were fearful of going into places. You know, we sat down with people who were gang members who were willing to talk to us, and they said, well, nobody ever asked us what we think, you know? And I don't call people who are in my films characters, I call them participants. You know, we had someone once say, I'm not a character, I'm a person. And so going in that way and approaching and gaining their trust and respect was really what did it. But it was also very challenging because Chicago, the city, wasn't very open to us discussing as a violent city. But we just went right to the people. You know, the woman you saw sitting there, she was actually born in, I think, 19... When we talked to her, she was 110 years old. Wow. The woman who was sitting with the pink dress. Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And she's very present. We asked her what she wanted to be on the show, and she's like, bring me a Starbucks caramel macchiato. It was all right. It's working out. And we sat down with her, and it was, she was telling her story, you know? And when you welcome people to tell their story, the city may say no, the police may say no, but if you go right to the people, you get a whole different approach and experience.
And speaking, you know, of telling stories, I mean, I think about what it's like to extract something very painful from folks. And you've done that countless times. And briefly, just tell me, what was that like? I mean, this is a painful history. This is stuff that people want to bury. They don't want to talk about it. And sometimes digging it up hurts.
Yeah, I think when we live in the truth of our history, we actually have the chance to go forward and not make the same mistakes again, for one. And we also learn a lot about ourselves. I think about so much of my history that was covered, that was not illustrated, that was not shared, that was right in front of me. You know, I read Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, and I felt like I was talking to my grandparents when I read that story, because I was hearing all the stories that I kind of heard about, but didn't really hear about. So, you know, I actually was at a school once, and this girl said, so your movies are called The Prep School Negro, I'm Not Racist, Am I? Like, why are you, what's going on, you know?
What kind of stories are you doing?
Right, yeah. And I said, and I live by this line, I do this work for very selfish reasons. I do it so I can sleep better at night.
Yeah.
So I can do something to try and help change the world.
Wonderful, I love that. Let's take a look at another film, which explores the topic of grief. Through stories of love, loss, and hope. It's called Meet Me Where I Am. Let's take a look at this excerpt.
One second. I could almost narrate
yeah.
it.
Yeah, let's, well, clearly. Tell us about the character in your story, Adolphus yeah. Nickelberry. Tell us about the story, why you created this film.
Yeah, so that's Adolphus here on the screen right there right now. Adolphus was a man who was strung out on drugs until he was in his late 50s. And his daughter, who he was disconnected with, had a child. And the thought was like, I got to clean up so I can be in this child's life. So I can't miss my first grandchild. And he's grew up in Utah, and I can relate. He was he and his sister were two black kids in an all-white school in Utah, and that kind of affected him in a way. And he just got strung out on drugs from 15 all the way to late 50s. And this program in Utah, they asked us to come and partner with Sundance to tell his story because he's so amazing. This guy is just incredible. And that's his daughter right there, Candace, mm-hmm. and that's the baby.
She's so cute.
Oh, she's adorable. And he went through a program that Utah Health funds and put together, and the whole idea is to have this outpatient-focused program where someone is strung out, someone is suffering. When they go to the ER, it's so expensive. But if there's an outpatient-focused clinic where they can come to and they have total treatment and they zero in on these patients, that has a whole different experience. And so the story was about listening to him, and they're the people right there. That's the clinic, actually, right there. And they work so extensively. And the great thing about this movie, and this is why I make this stuff, this was a struggling program. Population health is what they focus on, and that means you find one particular population and focus on them. They were doing fine. After the movie, their budget was multiplied by 10 because the state was like, oh, well, this is what's happening there? Even though they sent letters and meetings and conversations, they saw Adolphus and saw this story, and the state upped the funding by so much more, which is so exciting. So, like, that's why I make these movies.
And I just want to point out, yeah. this clinic provides trauma-informed care. And when people say those words, they are very woo-woo. Yeah. Like, and most, yeah. the average person doesn't know what that means when you say that, and I hear it all the time. But as a filmmaker, mm-hmm. you take those words, and you help people understand yeah. through visual, and so explain that part of it, because this is a true education.
Yeah, you know, what I do is I let the characters tell their story.
Yeah.
As opposed to me like, this is Adolphus, you see him, that's not anthropology, it's actually a real experience. So Adolphus really communicates and shares what happened to him so deeply and so emotionally, and the trauma-induced care, you know, it's not just check your blood pressure, it's, did you eat last week? Where are you living? We're going to send a car to bring you here. We're going to send a car to take you home. If you need to call us at 2 in the morning, we're here for you.
And also, what happened to you?
Yes, what happened to you? Yes, what happened to you? Because trauma is deep.
Yeah. And this is, it's like a new wave of actually saying, oh, this person has problems. We're going to look at what happened. And one of my favorites is the next clip we're about to show. It's from one of your more recent documentaries. It's called The Road to Justice. Take a look.
Fingers crossed.
What he did? Oh, I saw that. He was in the background.
She said, I can't dance.
No.
Oh, my gosh. So how are you feeling about the trip so far? Like, what do you think about the things you're learning today? You went to Jackson, Mississippi. You went up into the Delta.
I feel like a lot of people should come on a trip to learn, because they might know a little bit about our history, but they don't know about exactly, like, what happened.
Yeah.
Just the thought of how that could have been you in that instance.
Thank you.
campus of Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now, and their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
I just don't feel that they have a right to go to school.
I don't expect that my name will mean anything to you, but there is an image that is referential of what was happening when I first attempted to go to school here. I'm going to start off by asking if you have any questions. If you don't ask questions, make me think I'm wasting my time. Okay, yes.
How did you endure it? The hatred.
What people saw that day was not the worst that we had to endure. The worst was inside the school. From the beginning until the end of the school year, we were pummeled every day. The people who were not hitting me or slamming me against wall lockers or trying to lock me downstairs, they were among the silent witnesses.
I was a kid while this was happening, and I had no idea of what went on, especially over the course of the year, because the news kind of faded out. So it's
among the nine of us, nobody talked about what it was like inside school for 30 years. And the reason is that when I first started trying to talk about this, I would break down and cry. You can never have true reconciliation until we honestly acknowledge our painful but shared past. You can't skip these difficult conversations and get to reconciliation. It's impossible.
Stop and think about why it is that you've never studied history at this level. What's happening in American society that keeps you from understanding?
That was so powerful. That's so powerful. So tell us the intention behind this film.
I've led civil rights trips with The Nation magazine for probably about 8 or 9 years now. And I had the idea, I was like, let's actually make a film about the experience. And so we've spent a week, 8 days with middle schoolers, then 8 days with seniors who were 65 and up who took the trip. And the idea was to compare and contrast their experience on the road. And I think, you know, I'm sitting down with living history, and Miss Eckford is just incredible. You know, she was there. She was one of Little Rock Nine, that pretty famous photo.
Yeah.
And when I first met her, she said, come here, boy, let me talk to you. I said, yes, Ms. Eckford. She said, I need you to do something for it. If you see white people coming to me and surrounding me, just come over and tell them to step back, because it takes me back to that day. You know, I'm sitting here like, wow, you know, wow. So my thought is, what's the way to share this story and have us process our American history? And what are the ways that we show up and we're involved in this history? And what are the ways for us to move forward and not repeat that history? Because I really think that understanding these experiences, and then that message that she gives, that's the answer. And folks, so what can I do? Get in the room and have the conversation. And when it gets hard, don't check out. What you see in the two spaces is, on my trips, I have sit down with the people during the experience. So we stop after a day or two and say, okay, what happened for you today? And we process it and try and go through it. So my goal with this film, and I love to share this too, like I step back and I exec produce this film. I hired and brought in a young white man, a young black woman, and had them co-direct. So I wanted their fresh eyes on the story, and I wanted to sort of practice what we're preaching with this civil rights movement.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me were two things. Number one, her statement that they didn't even talk about it for 30 years. You know, and you mentioned that earlier, the people who went through the civil rights movement, a lot of people who went through Great Migration. My grandmother, who passed 15 years ago, never talked about sharecropping mm-hmm. before they came up
yeah.
from the South. That you couldn't pull it out of her.
No.
And so, and then the other thing that struck me was the understanding and the tears of the people in the audience. Can you sort of dig into like what that means, that level of when you're able to get someone like Miss Elizabeth to share, mm-hmm. but also to get that level of understanding and empathy?
Yeah, I think the best way to sum it up was we had a New York Times writer on one of our trips. And also one of our first trips, we had a woman who worked with Julian Bond. And I was like, what can I teach you about civil rights? That was a struggle, but it worked out. The New York Times writer guy, he turned to me and he said, you know what? I knew civil rights, but after this trip, I feel civil rights.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's it. That is it. We go into these places, and it's not me saying, and here you have this tree. It really is sitting down with the actual people. We go to 16th Street Baptist Church and sit with one of the women who was a little girl. She would have been the fifth girl, but she was in a different spot. Those are all her friends and the girls that were, when the church was bombed, Montgomery, I'm getting emotional thinking about it. But in Birmingham, Alabama, when the church was bombed and the four little girls were killed, we sit with the woman who was there, who was thrown across the room, and we just hear from them. And they're telling people, like, it's great for you to hear my history, but I want to ask, what are you going to do when you go home? What are you going to do when you go home? Yeah. How are you going to change? How are you going to affect the world? What does understanding this history mean to you? And what can you actually do in our American society to push that change? So for me, I want people to know and understand who we are. You know, as I said, I begged my grandparents to tell me what was happening, and they just couldn't talk about it. And as an adult, I get it. Imagine being afraid that someone will come into your house, pull you out, lynch you, and there's nothing that can be done. And they live with that every day. And moving to Philadelphia was the way to escape that. And they came to Philadelphia and had these jobs that paid very little, but they were happy because they weren't in the field anymore, and they had less of a threat of being lynched and being pulled out of the house. But then you think about police violence, et cetera, and it's just, I get it why they didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know?
They didn't want to pass that on to their children, very likely.
Right.
So it's so important to tell these stories, especially because we're losing so many of those history makers.
Yeah.
And we're going to open things up to questions from the audience in just a moment, but so what you working on now, Andre? Tell us. What's coming up?
I want to get some sleep after working on this campaign. But my next film project, which we've been filming for a year or so, it's a group here in Philadelphia called Bridging the Gaps. And it's Temple, Drexel, Jefferson, and UPenn, a school in Erie, Pennsylvania, a school in Pittsburgh, Lehigh. And what they do is they work with people who are in medical training professions. And that ranges from movement therapists to brain surgeons. And the whole idea is, how can we interrupt inequity in health by actually training the future practitioners? So the students take part in a summer program where they go into all kinds of, like, they go to Smith Playground. They go to, like, the tennis racket club up in Germantown. They go to Sankofa, the outdoor garden in West Philadelphia. Because health and healthcare means more than just a stethoscope or a blood pressure reading. Having somewhere to play outside is health. So the program is 35 years old, and it's really hard to explain because it's very intricate, and they've been so insular, and it is like these like academic, educational, medical people that don't know how to, I'm not being unkind.
Speak to lay people.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So they were like, can you translate what we're doing into a film? And I said, sure. And so the goal with that'll be out by fall of next year, where we have about 3 more days of filming. And the goal is to, like, let's talk about health inequity in America and show a solution. Because this program, it started with 4 people at UPenn who were like, we're in this ivory tower, but West Philly's right there. How could we be more involved in the community? And they did this great experiment where they put, like, stethoscopes on little kids and taught them how to do blood pressure readings, like little middle schools in West Philadelphia. And the parents were like, what are y'all doing with my children? And that got the community involved, and it has evolved, and they've taken 6,200 people to the program since those first 4. So my job is to find a way to tell, and they didn't want a branded commercial, they want an emotional story, which I know I'm good at. which is my forte and my universe. They want an emotional story to be part of it.
So you don't just pick hard concepts. Yeah, right. I mean, I'm just saying, you just don't do anything easy.
These are
complicated, nuanced, emotional storytelling. Can we give Andre Robert Lee a round of applause? Yes. And we do have a microphone. And if you have questions, if you could just raise your hand. And then make sure you speak into the microphone, your name, and ask a question.
Hi, I'm Linda. And it's not so much a question as it is a comment and a commendation to you, because this is so important given critical race theory that wants to remove and stop certain parts of history that make people uncomfortable. And if that's removed from schools, we won't have that source. And so it's more of oral storytelling, but also definitely the movies and the videos and all the things that you're doing that help keep those stories active. Because when we're silenced, people forget, and then they create their own history, which is just, it's skewed to benefit them. So thank you for doing this, and please don't stop. And in fact, get people to replace you when you decide you want to do something else.
Oh, I have a ton of kids that I'm training every day.
Quick follow-up to that. I mean, as an educator, so you have, you're a teacher, educator on one hand, filmmaker who loves to tell stories about history, and sometimes hard to tell history. Your thoughts on what was the issues of some of this history could be erased. I mean, there's a fight to make sure it's not erased.
Yeah. I think, you know, and it's funny because I see four of my co-teachers in the audience and one had to dart out. You know, when you get people that really care about these issues and care about students and care about the truth and history and art, you know, they make the difference. So as Linda said, people want to erase some stuff because it's too hard to deal with. Mm-hmm. I push back on that as much as possible.
Or whitewash it. Yeah.
Whitewash it, yeah, literally. Mm-hmm. I think that we need people who are committed and dedicated to these issues who won't stop and won't take no for an answer. And I do this all the time when the school or administration says no, I shut my door and I do it anyhow, you know, and find a way to communicate these concepts and ideas.
Yeah, beautiful. There's a question over there.
I'm Gary. Thank you for being here. Much needed. So my question is, if you can talk about funding, the great work that you do. I mean, you have rent to pay. This equipment is expensive. Mm-hmm. And I'm also wondering if it might be easier to get funding from red states, because one of your films was from Utah, you know, the reddest of states.
Mm. Yeah, funding is tricky. And you need to have tough skin. You know, I tell people, if this is too hard, go work in a bank, because this is not for the faint of heart. And I've actually been very, very lucky when it comes to funding. You know, I've had people come. I'm in a stage where people are coming to me with a project, which is great. My first project, I found a family that got behind the whole movie and put it together. Funding is tricky. You know, it's also doable. You need the right partners. That's the thing I've really had in place. I had people working with me that really understood how to approach this world. And I do believe that when you live and push through with integrity, it's going to come. It won't be easy, but it's going to come. But funding is very tricky and difficult. But I've been lucky, I will say that, and fortunate. And I think, I'll say this, I think my skill set and my integrity and push married to that luck has resulted in some really beneficial moments.
Beautiful. We have another couple questions. We have one here and then one in the.
Thank you. This nice, well-dressed woman picked up my question, but I have a kind of follow-up to that. I know this is a can of worms, and I know what we can do about it, but the Department of Education is about to be deleted and replaced with the Department of, what do you call that? Indoctrination. Is there anything we can do about that?
That's a heavy one right there.
It sure is. You know, and all right, let me get my magic wand out. And, You know, when I was driving home last night at about midnight, coming from my friend's house, I was talking to the universe, and I was like, universe, ancestors, God, whoever's listening, like, what do you want me to do now after what just happened? Like, what do you want me to do? I want to understand. And when we talked this afternoon, I was like, that's what it is. Because I was distraught all day until you called me and said, like, let's change. Because we had a whole different program set up. And we changed it because the world election, changed. Yeah. You know, that along with many, many other things that are have been said and dictated, I think about this. And this is personal from my experience. I think about, and it's weird to say it, but I celebrate and honor the fact that I'm a survivor of, my ancestors were enslaved. So I made it somehow through. And I believe that energy and that belief and that push and that drive is what got me through. Because I've been thinking so much today about the Dred Scott case and Plessy versus Ferguson. And thinking, like, what do those people think when that decision was made that just said, like, you are not a citizen, you do not deserve equal? Like, how did people survive? And people did it, you know? You know, we do have checks and balances. Let's hope the new leader doesn't destroy all of them, which he has said he would. I want to believe in the light that is this country. And then also, I'm going to keep doing what I can do on my little part to fight and push against it, you know? You know, I had to spend a lot of time reading the 2025 document for the project for the film projects. It's really horrific, you know, and it's very intentional. And we are already seeing the work that was put in place in 2008, you know, when Barack Obama had his successful campaigns. And where they played the long game, and they are winning. So my thought is, I'm not going to rely on a party to do it for me. I'm going to line and support where I can in those spaces, but I'm going to do all I can to find my voice, my way, and to try and get people to lock arms with me and for us to battle and go back and push against it. I don't know what's going to happen with that. I've been thinking about what's going to happen when these people that have been identified as, what do you call them? Call them hostages. When he frees all of them, come January, February. That's horrific. It's horrific and it's terrible. I'm a little crazy and I believe in the world and I believe in people. That may be the Quaker education in me, but I do believe that we as a race, we as a people can make it. It's gonna be hard, it has been hard. We've made it through some tough times and now we got another tough time ahead of us that we have to find ways to push back and fight against. And the moment you choose to say, well, that's too hard, that doesn't involve me, that's when you let the other side win.
Yeah.
Thanks for that question.
Look at you being positive the day after. I love it.
Well, we'll have to.
One final question, and we had, I think, yes. Did we have one final?
Yeah, she's, I see two hands. Oh, no.
Hi, thank you so much for being here and sharing about your work and your process. I was thinking about how you said when you toured with Prep School Negro, you saw a lot of people transforming. Could you talk a little more about that?
Yeah. there's so many stories to pull from. So people that I still meet today. So here's one. And I just got this one 2 weeks ago, which blew my mind. I'm not remembering his name, but it's a guy who's like assistant head at a school called the Green Street School in Philadelphia. And he told me he saw the movie as a 10th grader. And he was like, I decided I wanted to be about change just like you. And here he is in a position of authority making a difference. And I was so humbled. I was like, wow, like, yay. You know, I'm dying. I can't remember his name right now, but it was so sweet that he came over and said that. And I'd meet people that just said, you know, I thought I was the only one who felt this way. And it is cut across race, class, culture, of when you find a way, when you feel that no one else has experienced what you're experiencing, and then you talk to five people, go, oh, you too? You know, when I made this movie, I really was thinking, who wants to hear me whine about my privileged education for an hour plus? Like, who wants to hear that? And then I started sitting with people, and they're like, oh, I've really connected. You know, there's someone who just giggled, my neighbor, fellow teacher, who talked about how much he connected with the movie. And I was like, you're from Idaho. Like, what did you get out of the... But we have conversations and about what the experience... So it's, I think, what works about the movie, what made the movie work was it is a human story. It is based on my own personal story of being a lower-income kid, going to a school and a scholarship and having my life transformed and also having it become very challenging. But I deal with family, I deal with grief, I deal with loss, I deal with moving through. And that's how I think about what we're going through. We're not going to get over this situation, we've got to get through it. I really believe in that. And what is a way to find the work to push you through and find the way? So numerous stories that I could share, but I've been really fortunate to see people really transform in the sense of like they found their inner light and they ran with it, you know, and hopefully the movie will continue to just spark people to actually do that.
I want to say thank you, Andre. Robert Lee.
I got it. Thank
for
you.
Telling us more about your story, about your work. We've talked before, but I feel like I learned so much more about this side of your work. I met Andre through his work in radio as an executive producer in public media. But, I mean, that is just like a little side hustle because this is real. This mm-hmm. is so, it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I have to say thank you to you because I kind of stalked you on the social media because I was like, I hear you every day. And I was like, I'm in radio too. Let's talk. And for me, it's so powerful to be here at this moment. Mm-hmm. You know, and to be having this conversation and hopefully offering something to people at this complicated moment. So thank you, Cherry, so much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you. And thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you to the Free Library Foundation.
That concludes this evening's program. Thank you all so much for being here for this wonderful, really valuable conversation. Before we adjourn, could we just have one more round of applause for our two brilliant speakers?
Thank you.